that they use now are pretty big handhelds with good size antennas sticking out of it. The new ones are going to be probably a little bit bigger than the regular cell phones that we have, with an antenna sticking out from what I saw. So it's not as compact as, you know, our modern cell phones. So who knows, maybe they'll get to that point eventually too, if these things are really good. But that's the story on that. The name of the company, I don't know. I've read it somewhere, but whoever this group is that's launching this, they're up to $3 billion. I'm sure I can find that once you've ran a computer. Back to you there.
Thank you, Paul.
Very good. And then they have another Block 5 that they're going to be launching from the same launch complex 40 at the 110 off this morning. They're launching one for Indonesia. They need a satellite up there. The one that launched this morning is actually for us. It's for North America and South America. But the one that we'll be launching a week or so from now will be for Indonesia. So one launch coming up, I'm really interested in. I know we've talked about it many times on this net, is the Parker probe that's going to be going out to the sun. That's 3 Mondays from now. I plan on trying to watch that, but I believe it's going to be an early morning launch from Launch Complex 37B in Cape Canaveral. Launch Complex 37B is the only complex on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, that launches the Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV is a massive rocket. It's got a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. It's the biggest one that NASA uses. And it's going to be the heavy. That means they're going to have 3 boosters attached to it, and then they're going to have another stage on top of that to send this 1,000-pound satellite all the way to the sun. I know we've talked about it before, but it's amazing that they need that speed, because it's going to be going into the 4 million miles from the surface of the sun, so it's going to be going into a very close orbit. To get into a solar orbit, you need extremely high speed, and plus quite a few gravity assists by the inner planets, and this will be a 7-year mission. And the whole idea is to get below the corona. Now the corona is, you know, that's the outer part of the sun. 4 million miles off the surface of the sun, where this corona is, and the idea is to try to figure out why the surface of the sun is like 10,000 degrees, and the corona is 1 million degrees. So the satellite will be traveling through that 1 million degree area. And it's got all kinds of heat shields protected, and it will be able to do that. And I would like to. I don't know if it's a 70-year mission complete, or, you know, I'm not sure exactly how long it's going to take to get there. One article said I think it's 7 years to get there. But once it does, it will be going close to the sun, 4 million miles, and then we'll be going out. And, you know, it's somewhat of an elliptical path. I don't know what the high point will be, the helio, the highest point, Perry, what is it? I forgot the name of it. But you got a high point, low point, and I don't think of it. But what the high point is going to be far enough away where it can send the signals back to Earth, and also cool off the spacecraft a little bit, and then it'll come back in very tight again, 4 million miles from the sun. And they'll be doing this over and over 24 times. It will orbit the the sun and getting information on the direction of the solar wind and how the corona gets up to a million degree temperature. Still trying to figure that out. So that was interesting. Any questions on this topic before I move on? WS2.
Yeah, I'll help a little bit. And it comes to an orbit around the Earth. The high and the low, we call it the apogee and the perigee. So therefore, when it comes to high and low orbit around the Sun, I'm pretty sure they call it aphelion and perihelion. Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Very good. Mental block. Yeah, now, some questions came in. Somebody else I know, not ham-related, but they want to know, how is this thing going to survive this million-degree temperature? And it's true that the temperature is 1 million degrees in the area that Parker will be going. But, you know, I know you've said it many times that temperature is a measure of movement of the atoms. And that's what it is. So you're going to have atoms there that are a million degrees. But it's rarefied. So because of that, the probe itself will only be getting up to 2,500 degrees. And it's built to survive that. They've got a heat shield on there made of carbon, 4 inches thick. And the theory behind that is, actually, they had this on a website where on the NASA website, if you put your hand in an oven, and the oven is, say, set at 500 degrees, you could actually put your hand in the oven and, you know, a few seconds and take it out. No big deal. Let me drop it. So that shows that the temperatures, the movement of those molecules inside that oven are at 500 degrees, but because it's kind of rarefied inside that oven, a measurement of heat would be how many BTUs. I use BTUs. I know a lot of people use calories, but how many BTUs are really getting into your hand? And it's, you know, it's X amount. If you put your hand into a boiling pot of water, boiling pot of water is only 212 degrees, less than half of what's in the oven. If you put your hand in there, all those molecules are densely packed. You're going to burn the heck out of your hand, and you're going to get, whatever X was in that stove, you're going to get X plus a lot more BTUs into your hand. And that's what the probe is doing. It's going into a rarefied area, million degree temperature, but the particles are spread far enough apart, and the probe will be able to survive. It does have an active cooling system on board. So as it goes in very close to the sun, it's got a pump on board that's going to pump actually water, not a refrigerant, but water through these little tubes that are on the solar panels. They need the solar panels to be hitting the looking at the sun to some degree to be able to charge the batteries. But without this cooling system, the solar panels will burn up and 2,500 degrees. So, but now behind the spacecraft, you're at 86 degrees, they said. So, you have this pump, an actual tank of water that's going to be circulating through these little small tubes on the solar panels, and then coming back to a radiator that's also in the back, getting rid of the heat that way. And so, that's an interesting design. They have all kinds of things that they've done with this thing. There's some kind of a detector that's actually going to be looking at picking up the solar wind, and that actually has to be exposed. It's made of all kinds of different exotic metals, so it won't melt. The wiring inside this thing, that part that it's going to be exposed to is made of I think it's a niobium, which is it's really a metal that melts like at 4,000 or 5,000 degrees, so it would survive it. They couldn't use copper. They couldn't use silver. They couldn't use gold. And let's see how they do. There is one camera on board with this whole setup that will be taking pictures. So, you know, most of it is all for science, but there is one camera, so we'll eventually get pictures back from what it looks like when a spacecraft goes 4 million miles off the surface of the sun. That's close. You know, we're at 93 million miles. They said if the surface of the sun was a yardstick and the Earth was the end of the, you know, 36 inches, the space probe would be at 4 inches. So that was pretty cool. Any questions? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, here's something that came up the other day. I found it very interesting. It's something called the Delay Tolerant Network, DTN. And it's a computer system that they want to use for space internet. And I brought this up on the computer net because I wasn't too sure about what I was reading here that NASA came up with. They have these guys that are testing the system out, and the DTN, Delay Tolerant Network, is a system where they'll be able to transmit internet from, let's say, from Earth to either the moon or a planet or other spacecraft. And the present system is, if you transmit packets of data and it goes up and it gets received, let's say by a satellite or something riding around on the moon, these satellites or rovers only have a certain dedicated amount of memory riding around with it. And the present system is normally you transmit all this data up and then it's receiving it and it's storing it. But then if it doesn't have the end of the story because there's a interruption, either a planet gets, you know, goes behind the sun or because the spacecraft turns some which way, the waveform is. Long story short, if you lose contact with that transmission, eventually, you know, all the information gets stored on the spacecraft. And then eventually more packets come up and then the spacecraft figures out what it was talking about and it understands the transmission. This system is different. It's cool. You know, this DTN network system, they're going to be transmitting signals up to the spacecraft. And the idea is you don't want to fill up the memory in the spacecraft. You don't want to crowd up the limited amount of memory that it might have. So you transmit the signal up and it's going to the spacecraft, but it gets interrupted. The spacecraft doesn't store that information. The transmitter gets the signal back that there's been an interruption, and they store that information in the transmitter. Back on Earth, we have plenty of memory. And then eventually, as time goes on and they have a good path, it gets retransmitted back up to the spacecraft. So I thought that was pretty cool. They call that the DTN, Delay Tolerant Network. They're working on it. They've tried it already. Actually, in McMurdo down in Antarctica, and they've had regular internet messaging or actual internet traffic going back and forth. You know, you bring up a website, where whatever it might be, and they said it was very successful, and now they really want to try it on spacecraft and eventually the moon and who knows, Mars and what have you on future spacecraft. Let me drop it. This is WS2N.
Also use the term disruption tolerant networking, right?
Sure, Delroy, that word is in there as well. So I guess you could pick one or the other one that make up those three letters.
Hey, when they do that. They did that with APRS, and it's caused nothing but fights for the years that they've done it.
Yeah, well, maybe they get somebody in marketing and, you know, leave the scientists alone. They're doing good in what they're doing, all the engineers and working on these projects. And or have a contest, you know, like when they named Curiosity, or they named the other two spacecraft riding around on Mars, Spirit and Opportunity. They would have contests in school. And, you know, a third grader, you know, would pick it. That's a good name, and they go with that. Maybe they should do that, Roy.
I think it's DARPA that's really pushing the disruption-tolerant networking. It's a much more militaristic term, and since they're funding a lot of these projects, it probably will end up being called that.
True. This one's being funded by NASA, so maybe it got handed off. Well, maybe part of it got handed off to NASA. It's their people that are involved in this right now. So we'll see what the heck happens with that. Okay. Orion spacecraft is still under development, and this thing should have been ready to be launched by now, but. Yeah, there's been delays with the Space Launch System, the Orion spacecraft itself. But just the other day in Yuma, Arizona, they ran another test with the parachutes, making sure that they all open up correctly. When Orion comes back from the first mission will be to the moon and then back, and it will be coming back 25,000 miles an hour. Spacecraft will be heating up to I think 3,000 or 4,000 degrees, and after it goes through all of that, after it ends the atmosphere, it will start to open up parachutes. So they were testing these parachutes, and everything went well. They drop it out of an airplane 6 miles high, and they actually didn't drop the Orion spacecraft itself. Is like a mass simulator. It's like a big, heavy dart, but it's the same weight as the Orion spacecraft, which is like 30,000 pounds or something. And all the 11 parachutes opened up. That's how many they have to open up all the way down to the ground.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I wonder how much I lost.
Only a couple of seconds, Paul, don't worry.
Very good. These parachutes, 11 of them, opened up successfully. They have these two, of these parachutes pull the doors off the outside panels, and that exposes the parachutes themselves, and then they have two more drone parachutes that pull out other parachutes in this whole series, and then eventually they get to the final three. And they said if you were to add up the whole square footage of that, it would be like two-thirds or more of a football field. Three final parachutes as it comes down to the ground. But everything worked successfully, and they're happy about that. But we still have to wait a couple of years, I think, before we'll see the first manned flight. We'll see an unmanned flight probably 2020. They have it on the docket as 2019, but the way things are going, I'm going to guess 2020. And the first manned flight, probably won't see until 2022, maybe 2 years later. But it's still in development. This will eventually be, I guess you would call it a moon mission. It's designed to go to Mars. It's designed to either, the Space Launch System is designed to either launch the Orion spacecraft with a crew of, four to the moon. Or Well, an unmanned craft, it would like, in fact, they already have it signed up for the Europa Clipper. Europa Clipper is an unmanned spacecraft that's going to be going to Jupiter, and it's going to be orbiting Jupiter, and it's going to make 43 passes of Europa over many, many years. And you might say, well, why don't they just orbit the thing around Europa? But Europa is in a very high radiation area due to Jupiter's high radiation flux that comes off that planet. So what they're going to do is have an elliptical orbit, go far away from Jupiter, send information back to Earth, and then come in close to Europa, and, you know, get as close as, you know, maybe 1,000 miles or less from the surface of Europa. But to get that out there, instead of taking, you know, 5 to 6 years, they would like to do it in about 3 years, and they could put it on this space launch system and do just that. So that should be interesting. Any other topics, comments for the topic at hand? This is WS2F.
I may be wrong, Paul, but I have the impression that of all of the private organizations that are building spacecraft for NASA's purposes, that Elon Musk is doing the vast majority of it, that he's doing most of the work and the other guys are not doing quite as much as him. Is that, do I have a misimpression on that, or is that the way you see it also, Paul? K2LAW?
Well, if you're talking about the funding for the cargo missions and for the crewed missions coming up, you have two companies that were given money, contracts, for that initially. You know, they were all cargo missions. SpaceX got 12 missions, and United Launch Alliance, which is really Boeing, and Lockheed, they got nothing. You would think, okay, they're going to be doing cargo missions. What they wound up with was a $4 billion contract for manned missions. So Boeing is really handling that, and they're building this Starliner. So they have a rocket ready to go, and it's called Atlas, the Atlas V. So once they complete their spacecraft, they have a $4 billion project, money that NASA gave for their project, they'll be able to put it on top of their Atlas V and launch it. So you have that, and then you have Orbital ATK, which is now owned by Northrop Grumman, who initially got 8 launches confirmed that NASA paid, and they got paid, I forgot how many $1 billion, $3 or $4 billion to do that. And they launched with their own Antares rocket that they built, and they launched from Wallops Island, and they put the Cygnus spacecraft on top that they also built, and they've successfully sent over 8 flights to the International Space Station, and then SpaceX has sent their 12 cargo missions, and now they're above that. They were all given new contracts, new cargo contracts for future missions. I don't know how many $1 billion for Orbital ATK, for more Cygnus/Antares missions, and I think it was a few $1 billion left to SpaceX to continue to launch their cargo vehicles up to the space station using their Falcon 9 built engines, rockets, and Merlin engines, and they make everything. So it looks like, and by the way, there's another cargo contract that was given out for 6 more missions, and we haven't seen them fly yet, and that's the Dream Chaser. That's still being built. It looks like a small space shuttle that's built by Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC. They haven't flown yet. Give them another year or two. But they have contracts. I mean, NASA's paying them to complete the cargo version of the Dream Chaser. And that will eventually be put on top of an Atlas V. They have a deal with United Launch Alliance to do that. The reason it looks like SpaceX is doing so much more is I would say three-quarters of their launches have nothing to do with NASA at all. They'll launch for the military. They'll launch for the NRO. They have, you know, contracts now signed up with the military. In fact, later this year they have a Falcon 9 Heavy that's going to be going up for the military. Well, that does not come out of NASA money. The other flights that they're doing for Indonesia, for Bangladesh, they did one a couple of months ago, one right after the other, all these different countries, Qatar, I think, is coming up in about a month. These are all funded not only by non-American companies, these are being funded by completely, you know, foreign countries. And so three-quarters of their flight have nothing to do with NASA. So it looks like they're doing a lot more than anybody else. Then there's other NASA money that's being handed out. There's a company called Moon Express. They're building their own lunar landers. So they're being funded by NASA. There's a whole string of companies that are all trying to get a piece of the money. And they're all doing pretty good. And there's private companies. There's Vector developing a rocket launch capability. You already have one in Rocket Lab being launched out of New Zealand. All private commercial launches. They were coming up to their third launch with their Electron rocket. And the list goes on and on. And then the European Space Agency, they have their flights. And they launch out of French Guiana. Back to you, Dick.
The Orion spacecraft, according to the Wikipedia article, says that it could take a crew somewhere between 2 and 6 astronauts. Wow. I'm having trouble believing that in the near future it's going to go to the Mars or Moon. But I'm also having a lot of trouble thinking that there'd ever be an opportunity to launch as many as 6 astronauts to the International Space Station. So it sounds to me like it's being designed for a much bigger capability than it's likely to be used in the near future. Maybe that's just my impression. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, initially when that started to be built, 12, 14 years ago, they said up to 7 people would be launched on Orion. And but now, you know, they're down to 4. You know, if they go to the moon, it's only going to be 4 on that thing. And that's it. They want that capability up to, well, I guess 6 now, just in case they need a rescue on the International Space Station. A lot of circumstances would have to happen to need this, but they will have that capability. They'll have the docking collar on the front to attach to the ITER, International Docking Adapter, that will be attached, or already is attached to the International Space Station now, for all the other American vehicles that go up there, including, the Boeing Starliner, and the crewed version of SpaceX will have the docking collar, and then Orion will have it too. So this way they could autonomously dock with the International Space Station. That's definitely what the crewed version of the Dragon will be doing, and Starliner by Boeing. They will definitely be carrying up 4 astronauts at a time to the space station. And once that thought happens, originally it will be 2, you know, as a test. but eventually they'll do it four on a regular basis. The idea is to eventually have a permanent crew of seven people on board the ISS. So you'll be able to do that. You'll have, for instance, one Soyuz spacecraft attached to the space station. That would be three. And then another one by Dragon or Starliner with four. And then you leave that spacecraft attached to the space station. If that's your lifeboat, you know, for 6 or 8 months. By the way, they're extending it. All these different flights, they used to be 5 months or so. Now they're six. It looks like they're going to be stretching them out to seven now. So that's the story to K2RIWWS.
Thank you, Paul. I'm still reading what Wikipedia's got to say about it. Quite a project. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. You could get lost for that. Orion's going to lead you into the space launch system. It's going to lead you into the different space launch systems that are coming up. You have Block 1. That's this one that's going to be called Block 1. And then there's going to be a Block 1B and then a Block 2. So, for the first flight, you'll have SLS, Space Launch System, Block 1. And that's going to be one big external tank, very similar to the external tank you used to see on the space shuttle. And then side by side, port and starboard, you're going to have these solid booster rockets, similar to what you saw in the space shuttle, but bigger. The space shuttle used to have four segments attached to, you know, to a solid booster rocket. And that was the height of it. Well, this one's got five, so it's longer. And therefore more powerful. It's going to be, each one is going to be pushing out 3.5 million pounds of thrust. So you're going to have a total of 7 million pounds of thrust just with the solid booster rockets. Then you're going to have four RS-25 engines. They're going to be liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, similar to what the shuttle had. Shuttle used to have three of those engines. This one's going to have four, each one pushing out a little over 500,000 pounds of thrust. So that's going to bring you up to a little over 10 million pounds of thrust eventually. So then you're going to have the second stage above that. They call it the interim cryogenic rocket that's on board. Also liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And that will be used in the earliest flights, including the first manned flight, and maybe the second manned flight as well. Then they're going to have, at the same time, they're going to be building the exact same type of setup, except for the second stage is going to be, instead of one of those engines, there's going to be four engines attached to it. They call it the exploration, let's call it the exploration rocket for short. So that's going to be the more advanced one, so it's going to be a lot more powerful. And instead of one rocket on the second stage, you're going to have four of those same rockets on the second stage. So that will be called your SLS 1B. And that's probably about 5 to 6 years down the road. They're trying to push that up. They want to make that like maybe 4 years. The way they're doing that is they want NASA wound up with more money. So they're going to have two different launchers, mobile launchers. One for the SLS one, and then they're going to have the another one for the SLS 1B, which is much higher, it's like 50 feet higher. So it's a completely different launcher. They wound up with more money. They were only going to have one launch with the first one, and then they were going to take this launch complex, this mobile launcher, and rebuild the whole thing. They finally came to their senses and realized we need two of these things. You have two different rockets, one 50 feet higher than the other one. You're going to need a completely different setup. And at the top of each one, you're going to need a white room to bring a crew in, because all of these are going to be manned. We'll have the capability of being manned. And then the eventually, many years from now, you're going to have the SLS Block 2. And essentially, it's the same thing, except they're going to have much more powerful solid booster rockets. So that's the story on the SLS mission. You get into reading that, it's amazing. Okay, another flight that just went up a week ago is the New Shepard. New Shepard is a rocket that has now flown successfully 9 times to space. Not orbital, but into space, suborbital. And it launches from West Texas by a company called Blue Origin. Blue Origin is owned by Jeff Bezos. He's the guy who's like the richest guy in the world from Amazon.com. So Jeff Bezos, again, successfully launches the rocket. It has the capability of launching 6 people in it. He plans on taking tourists up. And we don't have a date yet on when that will happen, but this is the rocket that will be doing it. Actually, it's another iteration that they're putting together. But this is, you know, basically it's the same rocket. The New Shepard launches, goes up to space, 100 kilometers high, a little over 60 miles high, and it completely separates from the crew capsule, it's called the capsule, and that separates, and that comes down with your crew with parachutes and lands in the Texas desert. And if you put in New Shepard ninth flight, you can actually see a video of this, and they have it online. And the booster comes down that took you up. It's got a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket in it. It's called a VE3, and that came down and landed. They have a space pad, a little landing pad for this thing, and it came down, landed right on the money. So they're getting ready to do this. About 3 weeks ago, they said they released the information that they're going to be charging. Well, they know they're going to be charging people to fly on this, but the cost is going to be probably around $250,000 each. I know I talked about it last week, but if anybody didn't hear it, that's the deal on New Shepard. The reason for this flight is they wanted to see if the abort engine would work in actually in space. You know, so they got way up there and they launched the abort rocket to see how that worked, and that was very successful. So that's the deal on that. And that's pretty much it for tonight. There's a couple of other things, a lot of CubeSats are going up and things like that, but they're working on the Restore L mission. Restore L mission is a Lockheed satellite that needs to be serviced. It will be the first one that NASA is able to do that for, and they're building a robotic mission to launch probably in about 4 years, it looks like, from what I'm seeing. So we can talk about that as years go on. And that's pretty much it. I covered the Parker mission. I was going to cover the Mars dust storm that they have, but we already did that in the science talk of this of tonight. So, any questions or comments for this portion of the net? This is WS2N.
Now is the time for you guys to ask your questions on space, if you've got any. And I think I had one, but I'm having trouble remembering it right now. Let me stand by for a minute.
I know I want to make a comment, but I made enough comments earlier, but about the bone loss. And, what I've seen many times, and they found this out starting in Skylab, because that's the first time they went up for extended periods of time. the bone loss was 3% per month if you don't do anything, if you just like kind of like relax and no exercise. After that, the other crews, the other two crews, each crew was three people each for Skylab. They sent all kinds of exercise equipment to try to counteract that effect. Any comments or questions?
I think I remember seeing a number of NASA reports of what's going on with the International Space Station, that even with all the exercising the astronauts are doing, there still is bone loss, and they're unable to completely stop it. You grow taller in space because the discs between your vertebrae expand, and you do get a kind of bone loss, osteoporosis, I guess, not quite as severe. And as Roy was saying, it does look like we're not designed for a weightless environment. You get changes in eyesight, you get changes in the way the blood flows toward the head versus the feet. I think astronauts, when they're first in space, I believe they get a slightly large head because the body normally is forcing blood up to your head because it's fighting gravity. And in weightlessness, it's not doing that, so it overcompensates, if you know what I mean. So I've asked both you and Roy on a couple of occasions, if you had the opportunity right now to go to the International Space Station, would you do it? And I think both of you have said no. WS2N, K2IW, Glen Paul.
Yeah, well, knowing what I know now, I would probably do it when I was younger, but not now. I'm not worried about bone loss. You know, you have other health concerns you have to think about before you do something like that. But when you're younger, knowing what I know now, it's pretty safe. I wouldn't want to go up on the Soyuz. I mean, they managed to do it time and time again successfully. But it would be nice to go up on a new Dragon or the Boeing Starliner. Starliner still got some work. They might be delayed unless they can come up with a cure. They're thinking that in an abort situation, that when the spacecraft would separate from the booster, they're thinking there would be too much rocking around inside for four people inside before the parachutes really take hold. So they're working on that kind of a problem. SpaceX has their problems, but I don't know, that sounds pretty severe. No, you can't have this thing whipping back and forth with a crew inside. You know what I mean?
I presume the crew is held down to their launch pad, to their seats, with the equivalent of a very elaborate seat belt system. Are you implying that the rocking back and forth is so severe that the seat belt system may not be able to handle it? Is that what's going on, Paul?
Yeah, it might be too much. That's what they're, you know, what I've read. You know, I mean, even when I saw the separation from the ground, SpaceX did one, and it went up. It was pretty good, but it looked pretty rocky to me. So I guess it'd be, you know, even more rocky than that. And I think that's part of the problem with the pusher system on the LAS system. LAS is launch abort system. And LAS for the Dragon and for Starliner are similar. They're going to have rockets on the inside, which are going to blast them away from the booster on the inside of the, you know, the spacecraft. Let's call it the capsule. So, you know, I think you might get that kind of an effect maybe when you're boosting from below, where the tractor system. When you look at Mercury, not Gemini, but when you look at, because Gemini didn't have it, but when you look at Mercury and you look at Apollo and you look at the Soyuz manned spacecraft, they all have these rockets, these solid booster rockets mounted way above the cabin of the spacecraft. And when they go off, it pulls the spacecraft away. So there's no way in the world that this thing is going to start rocking. Maybe it has something to do with that. They need to perfect it better on Boeing. I think SpaceX, I'm sure it was acceptable. They've gone through it. They do have one more test, SpaceX does, before NASA approves them. They do have to actually launch a booster with a spacecraft on board and actually have it separate, at the maximum Q. That's where the speed and the pressure of the atmosphere is greatest, and they need to do that to show that they can successfully pull away from a booster. That test remains for them, and actually for Boeing as well. Back to you, Dick.
Did I hear you say earlier, Paul, that the next launch that you're going to observe is Parker? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the one I want to see that go. First of all, when you watch the Delta IVs go up, it's really cool. I mean, it looks like, like the launch of what SpaceX did with the Falcon Heavy. It's not as dramatic as what SpaceX did. SpaceX has their boosters come back. The one in the middle, they want to land in an autonomous drone ship out at sea. But it's the same type of deal. It's these three big booster rockets that NASA has, the Delta IV. But I want to see it get off the ground. I mean, this is pretty interesting, having a spacecraft go out to the sun, 4 million miles away from the sun. And we'll try to follow that over the next 7 years. You got to eat vitamins, a lot more vitamins.
Yeah, I thought you're really waiting for James Webb, but not Parker also. Now, when you say you want to watch the launch, does that mean it'll be viewable from Long Island, or you're going to be watching it on the internet, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, no, the internet. It's a NASA flight, so it will be on NASA.gov. You just click on it during the pre-flight time, and you'll see it come on. I have the app saved so I can see it on my tablet, and it's really the same thing. So, any NASA flight, or if it could be a Russian flight, could be a Soyuz or a Progress flight, they show them as well because they're going up to the International Space Station. So I get to see all the Kazakhstan flights that take off from there, and when you go to NASA.gov, as well as the landings for the crews that are coming back from the International Space Station. NASA shows them as well.
I remember following your advice a couple of years ago and seeing a launch from Long Island. When's the last time that we were able to visually watch a portion of a launch from Long Island? And when is the next one where we might be able to do that, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, the last one was Cygnus, but I think it was a cloudy, rainy day or something when that went up a couple of months ago. And that launches out of Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia, which I think is 450 miles or something away from here. And, but they, that would, have to wait for the next Antares launch. That should be coming up. Well, Cygnus is just coming back, I think, in another week or two. So they probably have a flight in November. It would be the next flight. Let's find out here. November 17th. So that'll be good. Let's see what time they have the time. I'm not seeing the time on this one. So I guess they don't know. But that would be the next possibility. November 17th for an Antares launch. Cygnus on top.
I'm a little forgetful. Tell me the main purpose of Cygnus, Paul. Go ahead.
Cygnus is a cargo vehicle. They've gotten it up to around 7,500 pounds now. And they started off around 4,000 pounds worth of cargo. And they've gotten it up to much higher than that. They've increased the size. They call it the Cygnus Enhanced. So it's a longer spacecraft. and more powerful engine than the Cygnus itself. So it's a cargo vehicle that is built by Orbital ATK, and they've launched 9 of these things so far, and it launches on the Antares rocket, their own rocket, their own engine. It's actually a Russian engine, and they call it the RD-181, and that's it. They have a contract for, at least 10 more of these flights, over the next couple of years.
If I add up all of the cargo flights to the International Space Station in 1 year, by all participants, make a rough guess. What's the total number of cargo flights to the ISS? And do they average around 5,000 pounds each? Over you, Paul.
Well, progress is around 6,000. SpaceX is around, 65. Cygnus, you get a little bit more because you don't have the parachutes and heat shield to worry about, so that's a lot more cargo that you can put up. You have the HTV launches. That launches out of Japan on the H-2 launch vehicle. That sends up about 10,000 pounds. That's a bigger vehicle. And overall, I'm running out of time here. I'm going to tell you it's probably about almost 60,000 pounds per year collectively of stuff, clothes, food, oxygen, water, science gadgets, all kinds of stuff, experiments, spacesuits, robots that they send up, this goes on and on, but material, clothes, and stuff for the space station, probably almost 60,000 pounds, I guess.
That sounds like around 10 launches, one every month or so, every 6 weeks. Wow. Okay, you guys, that was TechNet number 1708. That was Space Report number 178. That was Science Report number 38. Science Talk number 38. 73, you all. We've been by next week. I'll turn it over to Roy, if he's still with us. And thank you, Roy. Looking forward to what the wild subject you'll be telling us about next week. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Thank you very much, Dick. Thank you, Paul. And thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Once again, if you want to suggest any topics, ask any questions, make any comments whatsoever, the email is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if any of these topics interested you, there are links available on the page roy.ac2gs.com. And thanks to everyone. Have a great week, and we'll do it all again next week. Who knows what amazing discoveries will be announced.
73 from WS2N. We will be here next week, hopefully. And have a good night.
Are you at all concerned about that trace carcinogenic recall, Paul? I think I'm going to see if I can order the non-generic, the so-called brand name. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's what I have. And I checked. CBS is good at 100%. ShopRite, not too good. They had to send some stuff back. And I think Rite Aid as well, but I'm not sure. So, yeah, I looked into it, of course.
Are you saying you've already ordered the non-generic? Is that what you've done? And is there a rebate on the send back? Go ahead.
No, I don't have to send mine back because CVS is good. So I'm no problem with that. I don't have to change anything. I'm already on the generic version. Originally, I was on the name brand, and of course that changed. When their 17-year patent.
Well.
thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. Repeater system.